Call the meeting to order. Today is Friday, this is April 17th. Let the record show that the House Resources Committee started at 1:02 p.m. Present are Representative Josephson, Representative Seaton, Representative Tarr, Representative Co-Chair Tallarico, and myself, Representative Navarro. Let the record reflect we have a quorum to conduct business. Please turn off your cell phones. Thank you. Today we have Senate Bill 70 Finance, Senate Joint Resolution 18, and House Bill 191 on the schedule. The committee substitute for Senate Bill 70 Finance, I should have said. So, let me see, we have, well, first up we have committee substitute Senate Bill 70 Finance. Could we have DNR come forward to explain the bill? Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Ben Ellis. I'm the director of the Division of Parks and Outdoor Recreation. On the line also, to be able to answer questions, is Don Perrin. Don is the acting director of the State Pipeline Coordinator's Office. And also in the room here is John Hutchins with the Department of Law.
If we go any further, and we have also Representative Representative Olson present. Go ahead, sir.
CS for Senate Bill 70 is necessary to open a corridor to four state legislative designated areas, Denali State Park and Will Creek, Nancy Lake, and Captain Cook recreational areas to the Right-of-Way Leasing Act for the purposes of construction of a natural gas pipeline from the North Slope of Alaska. If we take a moment, you have maps in your we need to get this to the size. Thank you. Get it smaller. I just like to have the
one more.
Mr. Chairman and committee, in front of you is on the screen is a map of Denali State Park. Of the four, it is the only area that would have the potential of having either the AKLNG or the ASAP gas line within the corridor. And when you're looking at the map, the green area that is squared off in the middle are the areas, the sections that will be in the will be in this bill, and it is we believe wide enough that it would accommodate either, in fact, both if needed, but either gas line coming from the North Slope. The other, this one is the Nancy Lake one, and you see that the red line touches Nancy Lake State Recreational Area in a few places, but not nearly as much as the previous one. This would be the ASAP line. If you look over to left-hand side of this particular map, you would see this corridor where the AKLNG line would go in that area. So this particular state recreational area would only be impacted through the ASAP line. If you look at the Willow Creek area, again, this one, the red line going through it, and you can see the light green shaded area, that's going to be the area within the bill. Again, it is only the ASAP line, the AKLNG line is to the left of it on the map. And then when you get to Captain Cook State Park, this one is only focused on the AKLNG line, because the ASAP line would have stopped north of Anchorage. Mr. Chairman, this bill would accomplish the following primary objectives. It would authorize the issuance of a right-of-way lease under AS38.35, the Pipeline Right-of-Way Leasing Act, for a natural gas pipeline in an identified corridor through Denali State Park, Willow Creek, Nancy Lake, and Captain Cook recreational areas. The corridor will be adequate for either the AKLNG or the ASAP project. It requires the corridor to be managed as parkland and recreational areas until a right-of-way lease is issued under 3835 and returned to the original park and recreational area management upon the termination of the lease. Provide supplemental requirements to reserve traditional means of public access and minimize the impacts of a pipeline on the specific values of the park and recreational areas. It also clarifies the DNR Commissioner's power to delegate condemnation authority to the lease does not apply within the bounds of the park and the recreational areas. And it requires the gas pipeline lease to be issued by before January 1st, 2025, and pipeline construction to begin within 10 years of the effective date of the lease. Now, why is this bill needed? The parks at issue are specially used sites reserved from the public domain by the legislature. The way I like to explain this, Mr. Chairman, is that general state land is open to multi-purpose use, and leases are appropriate, and there are many leases under general state land, or Title 38 land, as many times are referred to. When a parkland or recreational area is created, and all four of these were created by the legislature, that land is pulled out of general state land, put into a special use area. In this case, it's for recreation. And that is called Title 41 land. As a director, I do not have the authority or power to lease Title 41 land. I can give short-term contracts for a user in an area, a concessionaire, but usually that's a 5 to 10 year period of time. So by statute, I cannot, or the director cannot, commissioner cannot, lease state park land. That's the basic reason why this bill is coming forward to you. Now, why does this bill not include state game refuges and the DNR Susitna Bay's rec rivers? Although some restrictions on multiple use are imposed on general state game refuges and rivers, these areas are not closed to leasing under AS 3835, where a lease would be compatible with the purposes of the reserves. So in that case, in those cases, they are not needed to be included into this bill. Does the corridor specified in the bill suffice for both ASAP and the AKLNG projects? Yes. AGDC and AKLNG have worked cooperatively to select a common alignment for both projects. AGDC has completed its route revisions to the common alignment, are now calling it Rev 6.1. Field efforts for both projects have been changed to reflect the common alignment, as evidenced in the geotech site locations currently be conducted within Denali State Park. Granted a permit about a month and a half ago to start geotech in the park along the areas that are identified in this study. And I think they're very close to being completed at this time. Now, the changes in Senate Bill 70 The Finance Committee CS expanded references in three of the four recreational area sections to include authorization to issue right-of-way leases under the Pipeline Right-of-Way Leasing Act in Denali State Park, Captain Cook State Recreation Area, and Nancy State Recreational Area. There was no change needed for the Willow Creek State Recreational Area. The Senate Finance CS changed the survey language by removing, quote, including land that would lie within the described parcels but for a U.S. survey, and replaced it with the language, state and federal surveys does not remove land from parcels described in A of this section. In an effort to provide for ample time for the Right-of-Way Leasing Act on the project, the Senate Finance CS deleted in four sections of the bill provide for termination of the lease if commercial operations of the pipeline has not begun in 5 years after the effective date of the lease, and replaced it with provide for the termination of the lease if construction of the pipeline has not begun in 10 years after the effective date of the lease. And also, in an effort to provide for ample time, the Senate Finance CS, in four locations of the bill, extended the date for the lease to become effective from January 1st, 2020 to January 1st, 2025. And the reason it was done in four locations is each one of those park or units have a section. So if you change one, you need to change the language in all four of the references. Now, a little bit of additional information. Senate substitute for SB 70 does not identify a right-of-way. I think that's very important. 70 opens a sufficient amount of state park acreage to the Right-of-Way Leasing Act, within which a right-of-way can be selected. The corridor designated in this bill would be adequate for the final engineering determinations as to where the exact right-of-way lease.
For the record, Representative Harrod is here. Go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
The right-of-way within the area authorized by SB 70 will be approximately 120 feet wide for construction, reduced to 53 feet wide for operations for the ASAP project, and approximately 180 feet for construction and 100 feet for operations in the AKLNG line project. I'd like to state there are no native allotments within the corridor proposed, and substitute Senate Bill 70 for Denali State Park, Willow Creek, Nancy Lake, or Captain Cook recreational areas. SB 70 will not affect hunting and fishing in any way. The access will be secured. Until such time as the right-of-way corridor is leased, access will be the same as it is today. Once the right-of-way is leased and construction begins, there may be some temporary restrictions on hunting and fishing for construction purposes, but only in the areas that are under construction at that particular time. And the bill provides for full return of the land to the park when there is no longer need for the pipeline purposes. We anticipate two releases of land. First, once construction is completed, the construction right-of-way will contract to the operating right-of-way. This will result in the release of land, which would become fully part of the park again, without further action by this body. Second, at the end of the pipeline life, the leasee will be required to return the land to the condition acceptable to the Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources. And upon completion of this, the land will be released and returned to the park. Thanks, sir.
Thank you. Is there any committee discussion or question for DNR? Representative Seaton.
Thank you. With the granting of a lease, does that change at all the availability of that corridor for oil and gas exploration, drilling, and development?
I have John Hutchins join me at the table. through the chair, Representative Seaton.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton. This is John Hutchins of the Department of Law. Right now, the land is parkland. It's not part of the public domain, and I don't think oil and gas exploration development is actually authorized in parkland to begin with. So,
thank you, follow
up. Point up?
Yes, and that's what I was asking. Would the creation of the lease corridor without a restriction or a change on it, change that designation so that it would then be available for oil and gas exploration and production?
The chair of representative, yeah, I understand. No, the answer is no. There is the statute as drafted limits disposal of the land in the corridor to leasing for a right-of-way for a gas pipeline from the North Slope, and that's the only reason that land within this corridor can be disposed of or used in any manner other than the park purposes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman,
go ahead.
There's been some question about access and road access along the corridor once the pipeline's built. Will there be a road access that's going to be along there that's going to be publicly used, and what standard of roadway would that be, if there?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, yes. Once the pipeline is in the ground, there would be an access road that would be built on top of the pipeline area. The discussion as to the requirements of how vigorous that road would be, or that access road would be, has not taken place yet. It's my understanding that it would provide for the need of access to the pipeline, the various points of checking of various stat areas that will be along there that can tell the health of the pipeline, if you would. It is my understanding and my vision that that would provide ATV access along that area, of which we don't have now. I can also see it providing snow machine access in the wintertime for recreational use that we don't have now. Unlike the TAPS corridor, where the pipeline is above ground and that area has a limited amount of access, this being below ground, the access should be as free as it is today once the pipeline goes into the ground.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just, but it's not anticipated that that will be a regular vehicle traffic roadway that is then going to divide the park. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, that's correct. It's an access road to be able to provide for the checking of the pipeline, but it is not anticipated that it would be a road as such. And again, it would be used for recreational activities. I could envision within the park of, say, ATV in the summertime, or which we have none of, or of snow machine traffic north and south, again, which we don't have any of in the park. This will also come by or near a lot of the right-of-way, the road right-of-way, the park's right-of-way. So that will play a part into all this as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just had a question on the AGDC versus the state-produced maps for the Denali State Park withdrawals. And on the AGDC map, they have the DNR additions to SB 70 in red. Those seem to be reflected. But then the blue is the proposed additions to withdrawals. But the proposed additions to withdrawals don't appear to be in this legislation, the sections that are in blue. Is that, or am I not? I'm trying to just compare the two maps and just understand what the difference is with these smaller blue parcels that don't appear to be.
Yes, ma'am. Through the chair, Representative Tarr, the maps that that you have on your left there are the ones that have been provided through the Senate Bill 70 process, starting out with Senate Resources, followed up by Senate Finance. That map has developed over time. The other map that you have is one that hasn't been introduced to DNR. We're aware of it, but I could not comment on this at this time.
Okay. Thank you.
Anybody else?
Yes.
Representative Joseph.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Ellis, the parks in question, I've visited many of them and done a lot of backpacking and that sort of thing through them. Captain Cook State Recreation Area has massive trees right there near the shoreline. I'm a great supporter of this project, but are we going to do what people are complaining about in North Pole, that there's a build-out before there's a definitive natural gas plan? In other words, will there be premature removal of trees and denuding of trees, that sort of thing? What's the time? How does that work? What comes first?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, this... And I'll get to the question.
Sure.
This bill allows for a right-of-way, which in the case of Captain Cook State Park is a 2,000-foot right-of-way because it deals with a 2,000-foot corridor, 2,000-foot corridor that deals with the AKLNG line. At whatever point a gas line is determined to be constructed, if it is the ASAP line, Captain Cook State Park won't be affected at all. Right. If it's the AKLNG line, then there will be further testing as to where in that 2,000-foot corridor the construction corridor would be created. Mm-hmm. So in that phase, it is my anticipation there would be no vegetation as far as tree removal that be going on. I would anticipate the possibility of some seismic testing for soil samples and so forth, much like there currently is at the in Denali State Park. At the point when the construction goes from 180 feet, when that is determined, then the area will be cleared, and then it will be reduced down to 100, and the 80 feet will go back into a sort of natural regrowth. But it is my understanding that there will be no movement on the actual, first of all, the issuance of a right-of-way that would allow for anything to happen in the area until such time as a determined route was decided upon, and the party or parties would go forward in asking to have a right-of-way through the Pipeline Leasing Act for these four park areas.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anybody else? Thank you very much for your presentation. I'd like to open public testimony. Please state your name, your affiliation, and limit your testimony to 3 minutes. Is there anyone in the room to testify? We don't have anybody here. We go to the Anchorage LIO. We have Charles McKee from Anchorage. He's representing himself. Mr. McKee, go ahead.
Yes, for the record, my name is Charles McKee, and I happen to have acreage on the Parks Highway at mile 88, 87 and a half, that vicinity. And so I was concerned about the right-of-way and how it would affect that particular area. In addition, I had faxed down to Washington, D.C., to Mitch McConnell, and I was referring to possible funding of Alaska LNG / ASAP pipeline, you know, pending hearing in the District of Columbia, which is, the state is a third removed. It's not a union state, which I thought, I come to find out, in Title 26 USC, it's actually a state of the District of Columbia, third removed, which is why the Bar Association has conducted its affairs in such a iron-fisted manner over the population of Alaska. And so I'll be glad to submit this transmittal that, in addition to a cover page from United States Senator Dan Sullivan. And so I'll include this in testimony along with my concern of the route and how it might impact my particular acreage and the possibility that I might have a direct impact because of the passage of the workers' compensation legislation that I'm now a victim of, because I was injured on the job and I have no ability to go after damages because of that legislation. And so I could easily, with the reduction of my ability of income, I went from a $2,000, which is basically poverty level, to $1,000, and no ability to compensate myself in addition through the damage caused by the lack of proper safety material would have mitigated the injury to begin with. Now, what I'm saying is I could lose my land for lack of payment to the bank because of the diminished income that I have, plus I have to get surgery, and that's going to incapacitate my right arm. I'm right-handed for a whole year. And so those things are dwelling on my mind as to, and so this is an accusation and an actual suit against the state, in a sense, not filed in the court of any manner, but the public court of Washington, D.C., and my local senator about how I've been treated as a vassal, uncompensated, I might add. And so when I turn this in, you'll get a whole report of my laundry list, and it impacts the Federal Reserve and the Internal Revenue Service. So I'm going after them. You have to be in between that bullseye, sorry to say. Have a nice day.
Thank you. AGDC can answer questions concerning trees in Denali. Is anybody here? AGDC? On the phone, go ahead, Mr. Baker.
Mr. Chairman, this is Frank Richards with AGDC. Could you please repeat the question?
Concerning trees in Denali.
Yes, for the record, Mr. Chairman, this is Frank Richards. I'm the Vice President of Engineering and Program Management for the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation. In regards to the cutting of trees along a pipeline right-of-way, that effort doesn't come into play until you're actually into the construction mode. So at this point, with the ability of granting the Department of Natural Resources the ability to provide a corridor or right-of-way for us in the planning efforts, that in no way means that we are going to go out and start cutting trees. It's once a pipeline route has been selected, once funding and financing has been lined up and we have made a final investment decision, that only until that point would we then go out and with a defined right-of-way, as Mr. Ellis has said, which is 150 feet for AK LNG project, only then would we start to remove trees.
Is that it, sir?
Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you very much. Representative Tarrico.
Mr. Chairman, if the committee's done with discussion on the bill, I'd like to offer an amendment that we have. The document that we have, that the amendment is 29-GS1820/N.1, and I'd like to refer to that as amendment number one, and I would move amendment number one.
Amendment number one has been moved.
I'd object for discussion.
Objection for discussion.
Is it on our table, Mr. Chairman?
I'm sorry?
Is a copy of the amendment on the table?
No.
Send out the committee members.
It's in the file.
Yeah, okay. Oh, I have it. Okay, pardon me.
All
thank
right.
You. Thank you.
And if I could, Mr. Chairman, my chief of staff, Julie Morris, can provide an explanation, and I think we may have some other DNR folks that might also be able to speak to the amendment.
Please come up, Julie. Thank you. Please state your name and affiliation for the record.
For the record, I'm Julie Morris, staff to Representative Dave Tallarico. The amendment is just adding small pieces to the right-of-way. The first one is added to, in your bill, page 2, and it would be under section Township 29, and it's added in, under line 11. It's section 5 east 1/2. The second section added in is number 29 under the same township, is southwest 1/4. And then under Township 30, under section 3, we add in section 4 southeast 1/4. And then if you go to page 3, there's another section added in under Township 31. It's section 21 northwest 1/4. And then you go down to Township 32 north, range 3 west. And that adds in the full section of 9. And then on page 4, under Township 32 again, you add in under section 19, south 1/2, northeast 1/4. And then under Township 32 north, range 4, section 25 is added in, southeast 1/4. And that is all the amendments. And I believe that on your table was a map, or there may be one, this one. If you see that, that's your amendments that are in here, in blue. So there's just small pieces added in along the right-of-way that's already been established. And that is what the amendment does. Thank you. Is there any questions?
Any questions? Sure. Representative Josephson.
Sure. Whose idea is this, and what is the purpose of them?
It's my understanding that particularly in this section of the right-of-way, mm-hmm. it needed to be wide enough to have two. This is both for the ASAP and the AKLNG line. Mm-hmm. So all this does is widen the corridor. That's my understanding. If there's any more in-depth questions, I'd probably have to ask DNR through the chair, Representative Josephson.
A follow-up then?
Follow-up.
So this was DNR's request, is that right?
I believe that's where this came from, was, I'm sorry, through the chair, Representative Josephson. The amendment they're very much aware of the amendment, so...
They're aware of the amendment, but it's not their amendment?
Well, I would have to...
Okay.
I apologize. I'd have to ask them.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Anybody else?
Yeah.
I'm Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Perhaps someone from DNR, but it just appears that there aren't enough amended areas to include every blue parcel here, but I'm not an expert in reading how these descriptions are done, but I guess maybe we could just ask DNR if that's in fact the case, that all of the blue, I think there's about 8 different ones here, and then there's just 6 or 7 over here. I don't know if that matters.
We have AG and AGDC to answer some questions. Either from Mr. Baker or Mr. Richards. Did you hear the questions?
Mr. Chairman, this is Frank Richards. I believe I heard Representative Tarr asking about the inclusion of the areas represented in blue, mm-hmm. and whether or not they were indeed incorporated into the amendment. The map that you see in front of you was the map that we prepared based on our knowledge of the request for additional parcels, and that's what we represented in blue. And I believe that lines up with what you have identified in what is known as Amendment Number 1.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When you look at the number here, it's, you know, kind of 7 additions, and it looks as if there's 8 or 9 pieces, so that's what I wanted to clear up.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, if I could explain that. On our amendment down in, say, for example, line 18, mm-hmm. there are actually 2 separate portions of the section identified, so if you check all of these where there's a comma, there are actually 10 different.
Got it.
So they should coincide with each area on the map. And if I could continue, Mr. Chair, I think part of this is as you can see, as it works its way through Denali State Park, this is really kind of a flexibility thing for the folks to find the very best location for the line as they come through. And because of our direction and the way our sections, of course, are square and our direction runs at a diagonal. So they're trying to just basically expand the potential footprint to find the very best laydown area for the pipeline. So I guess all in all, the easiest way to say it is it widens that corridor out a little bit in areas where it would seem to be appear to be very narrow.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
We have someone from, would you come up and explain? You explained it there to me the other day. Would you explain exactly what it's referring to?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Ben Ellis again, Director of the Division of Parks and Outdoor Recreation. As I mentioned earlier, the department was aware of the amendments, it did not originate in DNR. Our opinion was that the right-of-way, as described, was wide enough. That said, we're not opposed to the additions. Mr. Chairman, thank you.
You want to add anything?
I can't add much to that, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Ellis.
And then the area involved in this is, you explained it to me, too, about how much it is for each of those areas. Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, I'm at somewhat of a disadvantage as I haven't studied the areas. John Hutchins has just joined me at the table. Maybe he from the Department of Law could add something to the discussion.
First, before we start, we have Representative Hawker joined us. Thank you, Representative Hawker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Through the chair, this is John Hutchins, the Department of Law. This whole section is approximately 640 acres, and each of these is a quarter section. So each of the blue squares you see on the map will be 160 acres, a quarter of 640, if I'm doing the math right. So you just count, like, it looks like there are 9, so 9 times 160 is how many acres?
Okay. Thank you. Anybody else? Thank you, Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is for Mr. Ellis. I've just, in more careful examination of this map here, I was just noticing Byers Lake, that some of this is going to come pretty close to that. That's a pretty high-value recreation area in the park. And any anticipation of problems with that, or, you know, because you were saying earlier that recreation access won't be limited, it should be okay?
Through Chair, Representative Tarr, yes, you're correct. We do not anticipate any negative impacts upon Byers Lake or Byers Lake Campground during this process.
Thank you.
Anybody else? Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman? I think I objected for discussion, so I'd remove my objection to the amendment.
Okay, thank you very much. Anybody, any more discussion? Let's see, we have no one else on online or off net for testimony. I'd like to close public testimony. We have closed a public testimony. Any questions from the committee members? You have an amendment. Representative Tallarico.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to move the committee substitute for Senate Bill number 70, Finance, number 29-GS1820/N, as amended with individual recommendations and the attached fiscal note.
Any objections? Or discussion, please? Okay. Amendment is passed.
Thank you.
We have a brief adage for the amendment. For the amendment, number one was adopted and the bill has moved out of committee. Thank you very much. Now we have Senate Joint Resolution 18. Could we have Kerry Noor from Senator Giesel's office come forward to explain the bill? Please identify yourself for the record.
Good afternoon, members of the House Resources Committee. For the record, my name is Kari Noor. I'm staff to Senator Giesel. Senator Giesel apologizes. She had a previous engagement, so she will not be joining us this afternoon. And I will be brief because I know you have other bills more pressing. Before you today is Senate Joint Resolution 18, which is in support of Royal Dutch Shell's Port of Seattle leases. Senate Joint Resolution 18 urges Washington to stop interfering with Alaska's economic development, especially when it comes to the development of the oil and gas deposits in the Beaufort and Chukchi Seas, as well as the economic development in Alaska's Arctic region. This resolution also offers ports in the state of Alaska as other possible ports for Royal Dutch Shell to base their operations out of if Seattle does decide to move forward with the attempts to nullify Shell's current leases at the port. And I'd be happy to answer any questions that the committee may have.
Is there any questions for Ms. Noor? Thank you. I'd like to open public testimony. Please state your name, your affiliation, and limit your testimony to 3 minutes. Is there anyone in the room to testify? Is there anyone at the Legislative Information Office that would like to testify? Is there anyone off net that would like to testify? I'd like to close public testimony. Any questions or comments from the committee members?
Sure.
Representative Josephson.
I guess comments. Today, Representative Tarr recommended that I read the Bristol Bay Times. There's an outstanding, I think, a piece written by Mayor Brower of the North Slope Borough. I was pretty impressed by it. She made some very good arguments. Very good arguments. I've already indicated on the floor that I have real concerns with Shell as an institution, because their record in 2012 was really bad. And particularly with drilling in the Chukchi Sea, which is, I think, a riskier proposition than drilling in the Beaufort Sea. But I think it's sort of a clever argument in some ways. I take the point about Boeing. I don't know how helpful any of this is, however. And those are my thoughts. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Anybody else? Representative Tallarico.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I can appreciate the resolution. I read the a lot of the documentation from the governor of the state of Washington, and I would say I was more than disappointed to have a discussion of Arctic policy without the mention of Alaska at all. I think most of the people in the state of Washington probably have a very real feel for the only reason we're an Arctic nation is because of Alaska. And that, I felt, was there was complete misrepresentation in that letter with absolutely no mention of Alaska, Alaska businesses, Alaska residents, Alaska's future, Alaska's economy, Alaska's jobs. So I would say that I, from at least a personal standpoint, really took offense to what was produced. To the best of my knowledge, no prior notification. I think there's probably potential communication lines between Washington and Alaska, and there could have been some reach out and some contact with the administration here and things. So I guess the best way to describe it was more than disappointed with the letter that went back to Sally Jewell from the state of Washington. So I would say that I support this resolution.
Before that, we got a closed public testimony. I forgot to do that. A closed public testimony. Go ahead, Representative Heron.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I agree with my colleague here. This is a clever resolution. I read the letter by Charlotte Brower to the governor of Washington and the mayor of Seattle and the city council. Again, I thought it was appropriate. She had the same kind of speech when she spoke to Sally Jewell in Kotzebue. She didn't realize, a lot of people, including Sally Jewell, didn't realize that she kicked Sally Jewell in the rear end in her polite speech in Kotzebue. She's doing it cleverly as well. She's telling, I like that part about the wine and cheese receptions that people down there are doing. What bothers me about these government entities in the state of Washington taking the stance is they're biting off their nose despite their face, because Alaska is not a colony, and though it's been treated like that by our neighbors in the Pacific Northwest, this is the issue. Basically, this has boiled this conversation between the state of Washington and the state of Alaska is essentially the example that Alaska, as the United States Arctic state, is the issue that we're going to face elsewhere as well. When I was in front of Congress, the senator from Minnesota, Al Franken, he says, "Don't you get the irony?" And what he meant, "Don't you get the ironical fact?" Ironical meaning with contempt, is that you want to drill for your future, yet you want to contribute to the carbon footprints, and so your coastal communities will go underwater. And so this snapshot of what the state of Washington and the Seattle City Council is doing is just the hurdles that the state of Alaska will face for the foreseeable future. And I don't take this vote, I'm going to vote to pass, I don't take it lightly because this emphasizes our difficult realities in maintaining our sustainable communities and to have a vibrant economy for the residents of Alaska. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I really appreciate the last further resolve that the legislature invites Royal Dutch Shell to use a port in the state of Alaska if they no longer have there. We have several ports, one on the Kenai Peninsula, Seward, which is ice-free, deep water, could be very effective in helping them. And we have a lot of facilities there, training facilities and other things that could be useful. The further resolve, just before that, I have a little bit of a question about where we're asking that the legislature requests the congressional delegation of the state to support restricting Export-Import Bank of the United States to only small businesses, and that relates to the single whereas on at the bottom of page 2, whereas the Import-Export or Export-Import Bank of the U.S. has financed some things for Boeing. I think there's a lot of other things that the Export-Import Bank can do, and I would not be really wanting us to get into, impacting potentially Alaska businesses or other businesses that aren't involved in this dispute. So I think that we ought to put on the record that that is a, at least a question mark that is being brought up for one company, and it's not a general statement for all import-export activity across the United States.
Anybody else? Representative Carr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess, I can appreciate the message here, but I think the theme this year, there's sort of been some discussion on issues related to this, and sort of, I guess in some ways, I think we do plenty that we don't ask other states for their input. And even this session, we've had a few pieces. The sponsor herself has a resolution about declaring Central Park as wilderness. Now, I think that's probably not for serious consideration, but more making a point. There's been in the past, in 2012, a resolution related to the Keystone XL pipeline. That wouldn't be built in Alaska, but we passed a resolution encouraging that, and that, in fact, might have a detrimental impact on our oil and gas industry. So I guess we haven't been consistent is one concern I have. We, as a legislature, have certainly weighed in to matters that have economic impacts in other jurisdictions, and I think we just need to tread carefully in these relationships with some of our, economic partners and not be confrontational in our actions, but really try to work to resolve the concerns, because just as those individuals are representing the people in their area, we're expected to do the same. And so I don't, in some ways I just think it's, asking someone, if the constituency that they represent has these feelings, then that's what their job is, to represent those people just in the same way we should, be passionately representing the people of our state. So I guess I just want to be cautious about this, that we don't approach every situation in a confrontational way and, think there are alternatives through PENWAR, for example, a great organization. And I know Representative Herron's very active. I've attended meetings. We do things regionally. We look at the Pacific Northwest Economic Region and think about how we can work together. And more recently, there was a great success in that area related to boundary issues. And they've really resolved some of the problems with getting goods to go through the port there more quickly and be transferred on. So I think we can resolve some of these issues in constructive ways. And I want to be careful how we approach this so that we don't miss opportunities like that. And then additionally, I think we'll have to look a little more carefully at some of the work we do, where we weigh in on issues that are not directly in our jurisdiction, because if we're going to say the expectation is that others won't do that, then I think we'll have to hold ourselves to that same standard. And, you know, that may impact legislation that we've passed. You know, if we look back and with that same lens, I think we'll find that we've passed things in the past that didn't hold true to that. And then even in this current legislative session, I know there's a couple measures under consideration that are related to transboundary mining issues, for example, or fish management. And so I just hope we can find productive ways to work with these other folks and find ways that, you know, can help everyone benefit economically.
Anybody else?
Yeah, if I could just briefly, I know I've spoken already, but as I said, I thought Mayor Brower's article was really well considered. Normally I look at those sort of tit-for-tat things and I don't appreciate them, but hers was impressive. There was one irony in it, though. She talked about our needing to build out the Arctic so that we could do search and rescue where there were hunters sort of drifting on the ice. And I think the point of the pushback from Washington State is there isn't going to be any ice. So I did find that single irony in her column, but otherwise I thought it was, you know, she made her arguments well. Thank you.
Anybody else? I think I have to remind people everywhere about the history between Alaska and Washington, especially Seattle. Back in the days, excuse me, Alaska was Washington were closely tied together by the economics and also the closeness to and to Alaska and Washington. The as you know, back in the day, they used to tout Alaska or Seattle as a gateway to Alaska, because that's where everything that was coming up north to Alaska came through Seattle. And the port in Seattle in general. And so, and I know when the senator from Washington State and the senator from Alaska, Senator Stevens and Senator Magnuson, created the Magnuson Stevens Act on fisheries. And this continues to this day. Now, the interest of both Seattle, especially Washington, especially Seattle, and we see that on TV all the time. If you watch TV and these shows, and there's a story or a show about fisheries, the crab fisheries and in Bristol Bay, and all these ships, are these boats coming in from Seattle. A lot of them come to our part of the world and take the crabs, and then and that's how they get their livelihood from. And they don't do that in Seattle. They do that or in Washington. Off the coast of Washington, they do that off the coast of Alaska. So that connection still is there. The dependence on Alaska from the state of Washington, especially Seattle. So when I see something, and it really upset me when the city of Seattle and others start writing resolutions, and then I thought back to the days when the senators and the representatives from the state of Washington and Alaska worked together. Now they're working against each other. And that's not good for Alaska and not good for the state of Washington, especially Seattle, because we are creating a real huge economy for Seattle, and then they pay us back with this. And really upset me when I saw that, and I'm glad that my mayor has responded accordingly. And so I must remind those of people who weren't old enough to know how important that relationship between Washington and Alaska is, especially Seattle. Thank you. Anybody else? At SGR 18, is you have a motion?
I do, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. And I think I'd like to thank Kari for her presentation. It may have been one of her first ones, and she did a very good job. Thank you.
Yay.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to make a motion to move Committee Substitute for Senate Joint Resolution 18, Resources Number 29-LS0860/8, from committee with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note.
With that, any objection? With that, SGR 18 moves from committee. We will take a brief recess at ease to sign the committee report. Calling the meeting back to order.
This is such a good topic we're going to talk about here.
Oh. Next up, we have a presentation from Representative Seaton on House Bill 191. Representative Seaton, please come forward to explain your presentation. We will not take action on this today. We will hear the presentation and set House Bill 191 aside for future discussion. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for hearing the bill today. And I am Representative Paul Seaton, District 31, South Kenai Peninsula, and Homer. And with me is my legislative University of Alaska intern, Victoria Daniels. She's been working on this with me as well. This bill has been brought forward in coordination with consideration of the individual income tax, and that was based on a idea of making sure that we're fair and equitable treatment among taxpayers. And so what we're doing here is looking at making sure we have fair and equitable treatment among taxpayers, whether they are only Alaska companies producing oil or gas in Alaska only, and those multinationals. So that's what this whole bill is about. And although this is a pretty busy slide, it's just to talk about worldwide apportionment and what does that mean, and then separate accounting. And worldwide apportionment basically attributes a percentage of the corporation's total worldwide expenses to each jurisdiction, and then it uses the combined companies and all their subsidiaries, treats them as a single entity for tax purposes. And the problem with this is when a corporation's subsidiaries outside of Alaska are less profitable than they are inside of Alaska, we end up reducing our taxes in Alaska to account for the expenses occurred overseas or in the lower 48. And Mr. Chairman, I'm using the word profit a little vernacular. We all understand what that means. We're often talking about net margin, which is a term that is mean profit before taxes. So just to have that understanding as well. Separate accounting means that what you do is you look within the jurisdiction, and you look at the revenue generated in that jurisdiction and all of the expenses that are attributable to the generation of that profit or generation of that revenue, and the difference between those is your net margin, or we might say profit. So the solution that this method does is it means that everybody's going to pay the same. Again, if you're a corporation that exists solely in Alaska, producing oil and gas in Alaska, all your expenses are related to Alaska, then you are going to be paying, if you're earning very much profit, 9.4% on your taxes. If you do worldwide apportionment, the history has been that multinationals then pay much less than 9.4% on their taxes because they write off the additional expenses oversees against the against profits in Alaska. So the history of this is that originally we started with worldwide apportionment and found that the state was not collecting what it felt was its fair share from revenues generated in Alaska. So what we did is we changed the system to separate accounting. We were sued by oil companies. And that was going through, so from 78 through 81, we were doing separate accounting. And then the fear was with the, if we lost that lawsuit, the amount of money that we would have to pay to the oil companies, because they would be paying less under worldwide apportionment, the legislature went back to worldwide apportionment. We ended up winning on all counts in the Supreme Court of the state of Alaska. That was appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the U.S. Supreme Court dismissed the case because it didn't bring up any issues of federal importance. So in we'll just go on through here, and so this is the just the cover of the lawsuit case, and then we can see what happened in 1978 to 82, and that we lost the $426 million in interest, or this is what we would have had to repay and what the state legislature feared might happen. So a total of $1.8 billion was the difference in separate accounting, more money to the state, and what we would have gotten on those years through worldwide apportionment. And so that's when it was repealed. Here's a presentation that was made by Dan Dickinson of the Department of Revenue in 1999. And you can see the difference between 1982 and 97 on what the state left on the table or lost, or however you want to look at that. The difference was $4.656 billion that the state did not collect because we were using worldwide apportionment instead of separate accounting. Now remember, we're not talking about changing the tax rates on anybody. All we're talking about is talking about what you can deduct from your taxes as far as can you deduct expenses or proportions of expenses from overseas. Doesn't change the tax rate at all. Here we're looking at graphically the graphic representation of Dan Dickinson's report from the Department of Revenue, and you can see the blue bars are what we actually collected, and the gray bars are what would have been collected at the same tax rate under separate accounting, meaning that, again, the revenues from the state minus all of the expenditures from this that were related to the creation of that revenue in the state, and that's the difference in those two bars, and they're large. One of the questions that has come up is separate accounting. That would be very difficult to do, very hard. So here is just a synopsis of the states and the nations that are using separate accounting. Oklahoma and Mississippi use separate accounting, and in that first on the left-hand side, you'll see that companies in both Alaska and Mississippi, and you recognize all those corporations doing business with us, and you see down in the lower one, that's Alaska and Oklahoma, and you see, again, the full panoply of states that are companies that are dealing in Alaska and Oklahoma. So these same companies are doing separate accounting in two different states in the United States, and it's much more difficult there because they have very close adjoining states where they're doing oil and gas development, and here there's a large, you know, thousands of miles of difference. The question is, internationally, there's 80 oil-producing countries. For non-resident corporations, that means multinationals that aren't home-ported in those countries, almost all of them, or the vast majority, use separate accounting as the way that these companies have to do it. And you see that list of companies there, that's all our major players here in Alaska already do separate accounting. I might add that in the states, there's 10 states that allow both separate accounting or worldwide apportionment at the company's choice. And almost always the companies are using worldwide apportionment. But that doesn't mean that they're not calculating it all the time, because sometimes if it's more beneficial, they'll swap back and forth. So the next three slides we're looking at are looking at, oops, something happened here. Where did we get to? Oh, I lost. There we go. Are looking at oil companies, looking at ConocoPhillips. And the reason why ConocoPhillips is going to be on some of these slides is because ConocoPhillips is the only corporation which is required to separate Alaska production. And so they're the only ones that report it to the Securities and Exchange Commission. But this is for the top five companies. This is current as of the latest tax year, 2013. You can see the production tax value for the top five producers in Alaska. And so the reason we don't have individual companies, remember, tax data is confidential data. So this is aggregate data for those companies. But you'll see down there that the difference is in the the difference is that it's like last year, 2013, there's $355 million less paid to Alaska under worldwide apportionment. That was taxes actually paid than would have been paid under separate accounting. And you can see the percentages on the bottom there. Now, remember, 2006 was a year in which we changed tax rates. There was a number of halfway through the year, so there's a number of conditions for that. But you can see from the others, it's generally been a decline, so that now by 2013, international oil companies are only paying 4.4%, whereas on their corporate income tax, whereas if you were an Alaska-only company, you would be paying 9.4%. If we look at the next, which is ConocoPhillips exploration and production net income per barrel of oil equivalent in selected jurisdictions. You'll be able to look at these further, but you'll see on the far right-hand side the average is $18.73 per barrel through 2014 in Alaska, and it's $10.95 global's total. And if you look at the lower 48, it's $7.66. So when you look at those difference in net income per barrel of oil equivalents, you are looking at quite a difference, and that's what explains the taxes being paid to Alaska being less than half of what would be required if you were an Alaska-only producer. There is a problem with mixing oil and gas, because gas is generally less profitable. However, the companies have never separated their oil production from their gas production and have been asked to, and they have have declined to do so. Here's a graphic representation then of the total net income per barrel, and you can see where Alaska is, you can see the U.S. total, and you can see the lower 48. So the U.S. total is averaging Alaska and the lower 48, but you can see there's a huge difference in net income per barrel. And then we have some slides that are going to show Conoco, and again, well, I'm not picking on Conoco. They're the only ones that are required under the SEC to make reports, and we have other information. So if we go to the next slide, you can see this is from Petroleum News. This was Greg Garland, Senior Vice President of Exploration and Production in the Americas, and he was saying that they really liked the Eagle Ford because it was twice Conoco's global portfolio, meaning their global portfolio was around $23 per barrel based on that 2011 article. If we look at Alaska economics at the same time, 2011, you will see that we were looking at $118 per barrel, and you can go through the calculations, but the net margin for Alaska was essentially the same as what they were really happy with in Eagle Ford, which was $43.50, again, twice their global average, and so that's how you can see our taxes get diluted. If we look at their economics in 2015, you'll see that ConocoPhillips is very bullish on Alaska. They have just did final investment decision on expanding the H1 drill site at West Sac and going through viscous oil production. They've sanctioned the Kuparuk River S2. They've commissioned two drill rigs, et cetera. So the question is, how does that relate? If we look to Alaska versus other economics, you can see the rig counts. And you can see the rig counts on the left-hand side for Alaska, and that is starting from 2008 through 2015, and you'll see an increase. They're continual, and you see the same thing for the ConocoPhillips rig count in Alaska. If you look on the right-hand side, you'll see lower 48 in Canada, and you'll see the rig counts are going down from 2015, you'll see the same thing in the Canadian rig count. So what's happening is they're not investing in lower 48 and new exploration and production, and the reason is because, you know, you're investing for profit, and they're investing in Alaska because Alaska is a more profitable region. However, again, without separate accounting, those losses or those reduced profitability in other areas gets written off against or gets reduced. Their Alaska taxes get reduced by those.
Mr. Chairman, could I?
Representative Bob.
Could I interrupt your flow a little bit? I'm inclined, even though I'm very interested in this, to play a little devil's advocate. You through the chair, Mr. Representative Seaton, you talked about how the investment climate here is better because we're using worldwide apportionment. And isn't this the SB 21 argument just sort of all over again? I mean, what's the difference? From the oil industry's perspective, what's the difference?
Well, there's quite a bit of difference. We're not talking about oil taxes here at all. We're talking about corporate income taxes based on profitability of the oil companies. There was no corporate income tax discussion at all when SB 21 or net profit taxes were discussed in SB 21. We're not saying they're more profitable here because of worldwide apportionment. They're using, what we're doing is we're reducing our taxes here because of we are more profitable than the other places. And that's been the history. If you look back at that chart on, I think it was probably about 8 or 9, you see that all the way across. There was only one time in which a worldwide apportionment would have gotten us a little more money than separate accounting. And a lot of that is because the exploration and production, which Alaska is heavy in, is generally more profitable than retail oil sales and refining. Now, if retail oil sales and refining, if BP's gas stations become more profitable as a general procedure than exploring and finding oil and gas, then that could reverse. There is always that potential, but the history is all the way from when we started with oil through the ups and downs, that every year except one, the state of Alaska would have received its fair share under separate accounting, and it didn't under worldwide apportionment. So does that answer?
Well, if I may. This bill, as I said, through the chair, is very intriguing to me. And I voted against Senate Bill 21, so that shouldn't be a surprise that it's intriguing to me. But it seems like all the ads that I saw last summer on TV and in print, you could just sort of cut and paste and put in corporate income tax and how it will, cause, it will suppress interest in development and the positive economics of development. It just seems like it gets us to the same place, even though it's a different topic.
And through the chair, Representative Josephson, I don't believe so. I think that the profits are there, and then you apply the taxes on top of that. I don't think it's the tax differential that is driving investment here. The tax differential actually subsidizes investment in lower profit areas, because that's what gets reduced. And so if you go into with a proposal, you can actually say, well, our profit isn't quite as good because our expenses are higher, but those will somewhat be offset because we will reduce our taxes in Alaska. But it's to Alaska's detriment, not to our benefit that happens. So if we want to take a look at the estimated average oil industry margin tax per barrel, we can do that here. You can still see that comes down to the bottom. Company margin before state and federal tax is 1104. They're still investing here. The point of this is that rigs are being laid down all over in the lower 48 and other places, whereas current investment is going here because it's more profitable. If you're more profitable than the other regions, then you are going to reduce your taxes here for the expenses that are occurring elsewhere. And so just as a final slide here, the top five oil companies paid 4.4% under separate accounting. They would have paid their 9.4%, which is the statutory rate, and that would have been in 2013 a $355 million loss. That's not the average loss over the last few years. It's $220 million. But in the fiscal times we're in, $220 million a year is significant. And DNR, or the Department of Revenue, is here, and they can answer any of the questions. You have the fiscal note on there. Appreciate you getting the bill scheduled so we got the fiscal note. And
could I ask one other question, Mr. Chairman?
Go ahead.
Representative Seaton, through the chair, the history of this from the early and mid-'80s, am I right that, for whatever reason, a policy decision was made, perhaps because of your earlier slides where there was concern about litigation, who would be the winners, policy decision was made to come off the corporate income throttle and come down harder on gross income tax or severance tax. Is that the policy call that got made by the Hammond or Sheffield administrations? And is that the history of it in some way?
Well, I don't believe so. Through the chair, Representative Josephson, when I came here, we had ELF, which was totally broken. It was in the Murkowski administration. We were here, and we had the second largest oil field not paying anything. So there was not a balance made of increasing taxes. There was only a lowering of those and not going back to separate accounting, even though we had a Supreme Court decision telling us that was an adequate and appropriate way to tax. History showed us and has shown us until now that we would be better off under that tax regime, same exact 9.4% tax rate, but the legislature, for one reason or another, has not changed their tax policy. That's why we've got it here before us today. Again, what we're trying to do is make sure that the taxes are fair and equitably apportioned or charged to international oil companies as well as Alaska-only oil companies. So if you're an Alaska-only oil company, you pay 9.4%. If you are an international oil company under separate accounting, you're going to pay 9.4%. It's going to be fair and equitable. If you are an international oil company under worldwide apportionment, you saw the numbers. It's right down by 2013. It's down to 4.4%. So the question is, do the members of the legislature think that we should be charging double taxation on oil companies if they operate exclusively in Alaska than those that operate around the world? And that is the whole thing here. We do have Brandon Spanos, who's supervisor of corporate tax group, online in Anchorage, as well as the deputy commissioner of revenue here, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I can remember some discussions about this really important topic, and I'm just trying to think ahead as we move forward with some of the AKLNG activity, for example. Under separate accounting, would then the oil development activities also be accounted for separate from, you know, the corporate activities related to AKLNG? Would those be separate, or would that all be considered Alaska? And just some thoughts on that.
Since we have the Department of Revenue here, I think it'd be best to ask them exactly how the, if there's been any tax terms developed that they know of on that specific gas line. But oil and gas properties generally are consolidated as being Alaska operations in the oil and gas. Whether it's the transportation is going to be separated, we'll have to ask that.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your presentation. Is there any further business for the committee today?
Mr. Chairman, can we take a brief at ease? Brief at ease?
Or?
Oh, I thought we were going to have questions from the, we could ask questions to the department.
To the public?
Department? The Department of Revenue is online?
Oh.
Actually, they're right there in the gallery.
Or someone from Anchorage is online?
Oh. Go ahead. I didn't know. You should have done that earlier.
Are we on the record, Mr. Chairman?
Go ahead.
Yes, we are. Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Ken Alper. I'm the director of the tax division at the Department of Revenue. I'm not sure if there's a question that's specifically addressed at this moment. Would Representative Tarr please ask it again?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just was wanting to think forward of some of the, you know, big projects that we're working on right now, and put them in the context of what's considered under this legislation, and if you could give us some understanding of how that would work or how that influences the economics of natural gas development.
I'll do my best through the chair to answer Representative Tarr's question. Our corporate income tax taxes activities within Alaska. That it doesn't tax them directly because the relative profitability for those Alaska activities, which includes the profit on the production, the profit on the transportation, and so forth, gets run through this formula of apportionment where it gets compared with the relative numbers in other parts of the world. I don't envision any difference inside AKLNG. The state of Alaska's profits as an owner or part owner of that project would be, the state's profits, the corporations, the partners in AKLNG's profits would be subject to this tax just as they currently are. In the conversations before the body last year, say when Senate Bill 138 was being debated, the property tax and the corporate income tax were sort of outside the in-kind conversation. You know, the expectation was that we would be taking our royalties and our production taxes in kind, and we would own that gas and run it through that project. Whatever the company's profits were on their portions of it would then be subject to the corporate income tax. And that I don't see where this bill would change that mechanism in any way.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I apologize. I had a brain sneeze.
No problem, Mr. Chairman. I was no problem.
When on the air, so I gotta be nice. Call it a brain freeze, a sneeze. Any other questions? Or the department?
I have a softball question for him.
Okay.
And I think I know the answer, but it always helps to hear it again. Can you, through the chair, can you give us a couple sentences on the sort of the foundational philosophy between a royalty, a gross severance tax, be it profit or through some other method, and corporate income tax. What is the RAES, to use a legal term, the RES or IT, that we're trying to capture?
Certainly, but through the chair, Representative Josephson, that it's not quite a softball as you might have expected it to be, but the royalty is, of course, the owner of the land's share. In most parts of North America, oil and gas are produced from privately owned land, so the royalty would go to the owner of that land, archetypally the rancher in Texas, say, on whose ranch one might be drilling for oil. Alaska is fortunate in that most of the oil and gas that's been developed on the North Slope is on land that was owned and selected by the state. So we get to take that piece as the landowner, regardless of our role as the sovereign, as the state. The severance taxes are right as the sovereign. This is a resource that's a non-renewable, that's being severed literally from the ground. That's the root of the term severance tax. So we're being compensated in some form for the one-time removal of something that fundamentally belongs to us, a subsurface resource. A corporate income tax is separate from the natural resource world. This is simply our taxation power, also a sovereign power as the state, where for the privilege of doing business within our borders in exchange for the services that we provide as a state, we collect the tax on profit of corporate entities. That is a broad tax. It goes well beyond the corporations that produce oil and gas, but also to the other large companies that meet the threshold of the corporate income tax. I hope that answers Representative Josephson's question.
Yeah, it does. And as to the corporate income taxing, it's literally the fact that we're enforcing laws and contracts, we have a court system, all of those sort of privileges that we afford a corporation, basically.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, that is true. The fact that there is an apportionment mechanism is in many ways a simplifying factor, a way in which the various states and their tax administrations cooperate with each other to sort of balance the deck. Where this bill goes is to recognize that there's some inherent imbalances, specifically in the oil and gas world, perhaps because of the nature of our production here being very different from what happens in the lower 48.
Thank you. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just realized I forgot to mention one thing, and that was credits. We've got a lot of different kind of credits. There's nothing in this bill that changes, although we're repealing 4320 and going to separate accounting 4321. All of the credits that would be applicable to the current income tax that is being paid are transferred and are applicable to the tax here. So there's no sleight of hand trying to eliminate or impact credits at all. The credits are mentioned in there only so that all of the credits are available and none of them are available twice in the year in which they would be there. You couldn't claim them on both the old and new income tax. So the credits are not touched and they're fully available, just like the legislature put up against all corporate income tax.
Yes. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
One other question. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just wondering, in terms of thinking of the whole package with the credits and the investment, if you're balancing those things against each other, can an accounting system like that, do you think, lead to increased investment? Because if your corporate income tax is off your profits and you have opportunities for credits from doing investments, could something like this, do you think, lead to some increased investment?
Through the chair, Representative Tarr, the suite of credits that are currently available against the corporate income tax are somewhat different in nature than the credits on, say, the oil and gas production tax. They tend to be targeted at very specific activities, manufacturing value added, there's the refinery credit, there's the education tax credit, those sorts of things. In many ways, the corporate income tax, because it's got a broad taxpayer base, has been used as a place where credits can be used for desired activity. We can use the film credit as an example. Many of the companies earning film credits in that program as it historically existed don't pay income tax in the state of Alaska because they're not Alaskan companies. but those credits would then be sold and used by corporate income taxpayers. That's where they would end up being functional. And I believe what this legislation before you does is it maintains all of that structure, all of those credits, transferable and otherwise, can be used against either the traditional corporate income tax, which would continue to be apportioned, and this new oil and gas corporate income tax, which would use a separate accounting mechanism.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Is there any further business for the committee today?
Are we going to move the bill?
What's that?
Mr. Chairman, is this going to... Well, in the chance, I guess...
I asked if there was any further business. Apparently, we were done.
Mr. Chairman, we're done with House Bill 191?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have passed out, there's one other, we had heard earlier the labeling bill for genetically modified foods, and I passed out to, I think, everyone here an amendment for consideration that incorporated something that Representative Tallarico was interested in terms of the idea of reaching critical mass. And so I know I've distributed copies to everyone here that would make our law go into effect if four other Western states also pass laws. And I just, if we meet again, I just wanted to, request for your consideration that we might be able to bring up this bill and incorporate the amendment as something, we might be able to do this year if we have another meeting. And so I just wanted to put that out there so that if that opportunity comes up that...
I don't think we're going to have another meeting. Because Sunday is supposed to be the last day. Mm-hmm. So, and...
Being that I have very little control over whether Sunday is the last day, I am just preparing for making sure we have some, opportunities for productive work to continue should we find ourselves with a little time on our hands.
I don't plan on having any other meetings after today.
Okay.
And, so this could be the last hearing for, I think this is the last hearing for the Resources Committee.
Okay.
And we've had a real good productive year, and we had a lot of discussions, and I really want to thank you for not being shy, every one of you. And so it has been a really good year, and we had some real good discussions. Some got really heated, but that's what you're supposed to do, is to make sure that everything is off the table.
That's why they pay us the big bucks.
Yeah, and so, and I thank you all for those words of wisdom you occasionally said, like me. But it has been a real good year, and I'm sure it's going to be even a better year than next year because it's going to get harder. And we'll have more discussions, and all of you will be here since we're still in the 29th session next year. So we'll still continue those discussions next year. Thank you very much. If there are no further business, we are adjourned at 2:46.